Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video on a channel called God, Family, and Guns. On this channel, he has put together a Proof of God series, and I'm going to be typical of myself and start with episode 5 of that series, because that's just how I roll. So, let's take a look!
Seeing the proof of God in the world and in science and math and history is something that I'm always interested in.
Me too. Alas, thus far I have come up empty on my search. Perhaps you will finally be the one to actually provide something that could even be considered proof of God.
And I think a lot of other people, whether you're spiritual or not, are interested in because, I kind of want to always go back to the first episode of Proof of God. We always have to look at what is it we actually know.
If I wanted to get all philosophical, I could ask you what you even mean by know, but having watched the first episode of the series, I'm pretty sure I know where you're going with this. To summarize, episode 1 was basically the idea that in human history, the farther back in time you go, the less certainty you have about the events that took place in that time. And he stretched that out over 10 minutes by giving examples. We know that Australia is real, we know that World War II happened, we know the American Civil War happened, etc., etc., going back in time getting less certain about the details of the events. Now, he did engage in a not-so-subtle bait-and-switch in that video. For the things that we know today, he chose some examples that involve scientific verification. The existence of gas molecules or radio waves, for instance. But then as soon as we started looking at past times, he completely ignored anything science-related and went straight for events in human history and finished by trying to equate those with when scientists say that we know something happened 250 million years ago. Well, here's the thing. Even if I agree that we don't know exactly what the individual dinosaurs were up to 250 million years ago with anything even approaching the same level of certainty as we can know about the events of World War II, the fact still remains that we do know that the dinosaurs existed 250 million years ago. So whatever else we may learn of Earth's history, we know from this fact that the Earth is at least 250 million years old, which kinda spells trouble for your 6,000 year interpretation.
And I know that things in the past and history are real. I didn't have to be alive. I believe they happened. It's so incredibly documented. But the further back you go, the less documented it becomes.
Generally, yes, when speaking of human history. Now, thankfully, we don't need to have first-hand documentation in order to learn about every single event that has ever happened on the Earth. Nobody needs to have written about the asteroid hitting the Yucatan Peninsula for us to know that it happened. Nobody had to be there to see the glaciation periods of the Ice Ages for us to know that they happened. We didn't need to see the supernova that happened 168,000 years ago to give us SN1987A to know that it happened. Though we actually did see that one in 1987, as its name suggests, but because of the speed of light, we got to directly observe this event that happened well before human civilization developed on Earth.
And there's a point where you get to about 3,000 years ago where there's just not a lot of information other than pieces of stone tablets and some structures that have been dug up out of the earth and some pots and things like that, some tools.
In the field of human history, I would agree that typically the farther back in time you go, the less information we have about any particular event. But this is not always the case. For instance, we have way better evidence for the existence of Hammurabi, who lived about 3,800 years ago, than we do for the existence of King Arthur, who, if he existed, lived a mere 1,500 years ago. So we are much more certain of the real existence of the almost 4 millennia-old Hammurabi than we are of the comparatively young 1,500-year-old King Arthur, despite the recentness of King Arthur. So, as with most rules, there are exceptions.
And when you get to about 4,000 years ago, we get to kind of the ancient Egyptians. And, you know, so we can see their pyramids that we built. There's proof of that. But after that, there's just not a lot that is known.
Compared to what we know about something like World War II, maybe not. But that doesn't mean we know nothing. We know that farmers and herders traveled south from Ethiopia and settled in Kenya. We know that the Capacha culture in Mexico had its beginnings then. The first Minoan palaces on Crete were constructed around then. The Harappan civilization began its decline. Northern China began its Bronze Age. Horses were first tamed and used for transport. The Amorites conquered Ur. The 11th dynasty of Egypt ended with the death of Pharaoh Mentuhotep IV, with the 12th dynasty beginning with the reign of Pharaoh Amenemhat I. This is a relatively small and inconsequential list compared to what we actually do know, and also I didn't go into the details of how we know it, but suffice it to say that we do know quite a bit about this time period and can go back quite a bit farther than that with different methods.
You cannot go back more than 4,500 years and know for sure anything at all.
Sure you can. There's lots we know about that time period. Yes, the dates aren't all that specific, but we can still learn about the cultures and people that existed then. In China in 5000 BCE, the Humudu culture started cultivating rice. The Magiabang culture became established, and that's one of those cultures that seems to have just lived right through Noah's flood, having survived for a period of about 2,000 years. And I could go on, but I don't think you guys need me to continue butchering these pronunciations in order to get the point.
About all you can know about 4,000 years ago is some people built some pyramids, and then you can generally tell a little bit about their art and their culture and that kind of thing. That is about it.
That's plenty. In the case of the pyramids, it's at least enough to know that the Egyptian culture survived Noah's flood somehow, despite the flood being a supposedly global event. The oldest pyramid is about 4,700 years old, and the youngest is about 2,600. So that's now two cultures that we have found that must have somehow survived the flood in our extremely cursory investigation into how much of human history we know about during that time period.
But beyond 4,500 years, there is nothing known to be true.
For human history? Yeah, I might be willing to grant that depending on how we're defining know here. Well, no, I take that back, because they built the pyramids is a thing that we know, and you said as much yourself. But humans aside, there's plenty we still know from that time period and before. Hell, want to look 5,000 years into the past right now? Go find the Cat's Eye Nebula. That one's about 5,000 light years away, so when you're looking at it, you are quite literally seeing it as it was about 5,000 years ago. I guess I should confess. Okay, the Cat's Eye Nebula is really only about 3,300 light years away from the Earth. I fudged the numbers because the pictures of it are prettier than the pictures of Cygnus OB2, and I wanted to use the prettier pictures. But that stupid moral compass of mine won't let me fudge the numbers without telling on myself about it, so here we are.
Everything is just a lot of speculation. There's a lot of hypothesis being thrown out. And there's a lot of hypotheses that are being put into the theory category that I don't personally think should be there.
Uh-oh, here it comes. I think he's about to present theory as though it's a step in between law and hypothesis. A theory is a comprehensive body of knowledge. All theories contain many hypotheses and laws. An hypothesis does not graduate to become a theory, which will then graduate to become a law. That's not how science works.
And then there's a lot of theories that people talk about as if they're laws, like laws are laws, like 2 + 2 = 4.
Oh God, there it is. Yup, not often we see that one trotted out quite so blatantly anymore. Usually it's just alluded to rather than directly stated. And 2 + 2 = 4 is not a law, it is an equation. On top of that, it's an equation that, depending on whether or not we are rounding, is not always true. 2 + 2 = 5 for high values of 2.
If I drop a rock, it's going to hit the ground. Gravity is a law.
Gravity is a theory. The theory of gravity does contain Newton's law of universal gravitation, which is the equation that you would use to calculate the effects of gravity at the scale that you described, but gravity as a whole is not a law, but a theory.
But we're talking about things in the world that have to do with things beyond 4,000 years ago.
So what, you think gravity wasn't a thing 4,000 years ago? Hell, we can observe the effects of gravity from 4,000 years ago and more directly, both through the traditional observational methods like the various frequencies of light, and by directly detecting gravitational waves using new methods, the first detection of which was an event that happened about 1.3 billion light years away, meaning that from that observation of the two black holes colliding, we know that 1.3 billion years ago, two black holes collided at that location.
Things that people will say, well, hundreds of millions of years ago, here's how things were. And it's just, as a scientist, that's hard to grab a hold of, to think,
Hold up. Did you seriously just call yourself a scientist immediately after you demonstrated a complete lack of knowledge about how a scientist would use the words law, theory, and hypothesis? You're a dude who makes gun videos on YouTube as a career. That is not a scientific endeavor. Not to mention the fact that when a scientist can't wrap their mind around something, that's when it's time to get excited and investigate further so that they can come to a more complete understanding, rather than just giving up and saying, nah, must be impossible to get past this barrier because it's hard. You are demonstrating here that even if you do technically have scientific credentials, you aren't a very good scientist.
We don't even know what was going on 4,500 years ago. How in the world could you possibly look somebody in the eye and say with scientific certainty, here's how things were 200 million years ago?
Because we're looking for different kinds of things. You're talking specifically about human history. When a scientist is talking about an event that happened hundreds of millions of years ago, they are not referring to a human-caused event and looking for our human perspective on the matter. They're just looking to see what happened. Isotopes don't decay differently because they didn't like their competitor isotopes. Rocks don't form differently because they wanted to make themselves look like benevolent rulers. The speed of light didn't change because the photons wanted to have a tactical advantage when they attacked. But human history is subject not only to our interpretation of the events, but also the interpretations and biases of the people who lived through and recorded those events.
It's just ridiculous, in my opinion. It's easier to walk down the path of creation, because at least there you can see some things that make sense.
Isn't there a Bible verse about how the easy path is the one that leads to destruction or something? Should we really be making our decisions about what aspects of science we accept based on how easy we find it to accept them?
Now, that's not what this debate is. What I'm trying to share through these videos is, as a scientist, I found God.
Demonstrate that you actually are a scientist. And actually, that statement will still be meaningless. Lots of scientists believe in God. Most just don't let their God belief get in the way of their research.
It was trying to see, well, wait a second, you can't break the rules of science. You can't call hypotheses theories. And you can't call theories laws. It breaks the rules of science.
Statements like that are what make me question your claim to be a scientist. I have responded to many creationist scientists on this channel. I don't generally like to question people's credentials as part of my argument, for the simple fact that I have none myself, so I don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to credentials. But I can't abide people claiming to have credentials that they obviously don't. Though I would be perfectly happy to admit that I am wrong on this matter if he were to actually provide some sort of evidence that his credentials exist. I did dig into it a bit. I found a video where he goes through his personal story, and with how he describes his college experience, it sounds like he started out as a biology and chemistry major, but then switched to teaching.
And it was about then that I went to college, and at the time I kind of thought I wanted to go to medical school, so I majored in biology and chemistry, and early on realized I did not want to do that, so I became a teacher.
But it also kind of sounds like he just kind of quit college to become a teacher. He doesn't say explicitly, but I am confident here that his formal scientific education stopped at some introductory college-level classes. So, no, he is not a scientist, and he did not discover anything as a scientist. And his misleading statements along those lines are a very shady tactic, to say the least.
When people are trying to think of some new idea, you can't shut them out.
Creation is not a new idea that is being shut out. It is an old idea that is in its death throes as all the evidence keeps piling up against it.
So we shut out other ideas and we still call it science? I mean, science is literally the field of discovery.
Yes. And when you discover that a previous idea is wrong, you ditch the wrong idea. Clinging to it against all evidence to the contrary is not scientific by any stretch of the imagination.
Regarding the waters of Noah's flood. Where did they come from? Where did they go?
Where did you come from, Cotton-Eyed Joe?
You know, for the longest time, scientists have said, here's exactly how much water is on the Earth.
This is a figure that I've looked up a few times for back-of-the-envelope calculations. Never have I seen anyone give the number with anything implying exactness. It is an estimate. Never, to the best of my knowledge, has it not been an estimate. The current estimate is about 1.4 billion cubic kilometers of water, which, if it were all on the Earth at the surface in liquid form, would raise global sea levels by approximately 70 meters. For comparison, Mount Everest is just shy of 8,850 meters above sea level. So, yeah, not quite enough water there.
And then it was well known and well documented that that water actually came from comets that over millions of years would strike the Earth, and they just had some water crystals on it, and eventually that would crystallize, you know, over hundreds of million years, formed our oceans.
So comets hit the Earth, and then they would crystallize into water over hundreds of millions of years? That's what you're saying here? You're not making a lot of sense. But yes, there has been a question of where our water originally came from. The current favored model is asteroids rather than comets, as the deuterium to hydrogen ratio of asteroid water is much closer to primordial Earth water than comet water is. But those are methods that scientists use to figure out things that no person was present to observe, so I wouldn't expect you to understand. Basically, deuterium is a hydrogen that went back for seconds at the holiday dinner. It's packing the extra weight of a neutrino that hydrogen atoms don't normally have. Simulations of the early solar system can tell us which bodies will have a higher ratio of deuterium to hydrogen, and using these ratios, we can figure out where the water on Earth came from. Except we have to account for the fact that the ratio would not remain constant, as deuterium reacts differently than hydrogen, and just by virtue of the fact that it is heavier, it won't be blown off in atmospheric outgassing quite as quickly as regular hydrogen would. Long story short, the deuterium-hydrogen ratio of asteroids matches the primordial Earth-deuterium-hydrogen ratio better than comets does.
However, recently, what we have discovered is that there's crystallized aqueous ringwoodite underneath the Earth.
Yes, in 2014, we learned of this mineral, which contains hydroxyl radicals, basically water that's been broken down. Okay, no, we knew about the mineral before that. 2014 is just when we found the first sample of it that came from within the Earth, rather than being created in a lab or found on a meteorite. So, with some modeling on the geologist's part, we've put together a deep water cycle, where tectonic plates, as they subduct, bring water down into the transition zone between the upper and lower mantle. The water eventually works its way back up to the surface through volcanic activity, and this has been proposed as a potential origin for our oceans as well. The water was all here when the planet formed, and as it cooled, the oceans just kinda seeped out of the rocks. So, how much water is there? It's hard to know for sure. Nobody can just dig down through the mantle and take a survey, so we've had to calculate based on the measurement of dislocation mobility. Dislocation mobility is a measurement of how a line fracture can move through a rock. Essentially, it measures the rock's viscosity. Measurements on artificially produced ringwoodite suggest that ringwoodite found in the transition zone contain about 1-2% water by weight. This means that there is roughly 1-3 times the amount of water that is available on the surface, trapped down there in the rocks. So, if the higher number of that estimate is accurate, that might just do the trick for the flood if you were to somehow manage to get all that water to the surface all at the same time and be in a liquid state rather than still trapped in the rocks.
Now, this is hydrous ringwoodite, so it's waterous it's crystallized water underneath the Earth.
No, Mr. Scientist, ringwoodite is not crystallized water. Ice and snow are crystallized water. Ringwoodite is an olivine mineral that only forms under high pressures which can contain hydroxyl radicals. It's not like if you drilled a hole in the Earth down to the transition zone, a gush of liquid water would suddenly burst forth. Besides, drilling deep into the Earth is how you kill Stanley Tucci. You don't want to kill Stanley Tucci, do you?
What the fuck am I doing?
About 7 years ago, there was an underwater ocean of this stuff discovered under Brazil.
Yeah, the headlines were often something along those lines, but it is not literally an ocean. It's that there are enough hydroxyl radicals contained in the ringwoodite to make enough water to fill the oceans at least once. If you're picturing free-flowing water deep within the crust of the Earth, you're not picturing it right.
And there's so much of that water that now it's believed that the water on the Earth did not come from comets, that it actually gushed up from below the Earth.
No, that is an alternate hypothesis that has been presented but still needs further research. Asteroids are still the main hypothesis. And also, it wouldn't have gushed up, more like seeped out. Kind of like when you squeeze water out of a sponge, but if the sponge was made of a rock.
The new discovery supports an alternative idea that the oceans gradually oozed out of the interior of the early Earth.
Yeah, okay, oozed is a good way to describe it, sure. Now, I did skip a bit. He is reading one of the articles now, so please notice the word gradually there. If you look at the diagram that you're showing, you'll see that the water gets taken down into the transition zone through subduction, a very slow process, and then it makes its way to the surface through deep source eruptions, likely escaping as steam before condensing into liquid water. Put a hole in the earth deep enough to get to the ringwoodite, and you get a volcanic eruption, not a gushing forth of liquid water.
It's good evidence the Earth's water came from within.
Sure, that might be the case. Doesn't mean Noah's flood is any more possible than it was before this discovery.
And many of these articles go on to speculate that if all of this crystallized aqueous ringwoodite came oozed up to the surface, that it would cover the entire planet, that even the tallest peaks of the tallest mountains would be under water.
Yes, the amount of water found to be contained in the ringwoodite could potentially be enough to cover the whole Earth, including Mount Everest. Now, what mechanism would you suggest would make this simultaneous extraction of that much ringwoodite possible? Also, keep in mind that thus far we have two samples of ringwoodite that originated from inside the Earth, with most naturally occurring ringwoodite being found in meteors. If ringwoodite were the source of Noah's floodwaters, then would it not be a relatively abundant mineral on or near the surface? Did God meticulously gather up any ringwoodite grains that were left on the surface after the flood and then stuff them back down inside the mantle? Also, bear in mind that the amount of water contained in the Earth's supply of ringwoodite is a key player in tectonic activity. Less water down there means less continental drift up here. So if Noah's flood made use of this as a water source, then the continents definitely would not have had their super speed race from Pangaea to where they are now at the time of the flood. If anything, their movement would have been slowed down. So while I can see how a superficial view of this discovery may seem to support the idea of a flood, in reality, it's actually providing more evidence against it.
Now, that's interesting because we've known that for about 7 years now. We've known this discovery for maybe 9 at the most. Yet, written in Genesis, the first book of the Bible, which was written by Moses around 3,000 to 4,000 years ago.
Not written by Moses, but yeah, about 3,000 to 4,000 years ago.
It is written in chapter 7, starting in verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. So the water came from below.
And? What's your point here? That ancient people wouldn't have known about hydrous ringwoodite existing, therefore they wouldn't have written about water coming from below? Well, here's a newsflash for you. People have known to dig wells in order to access water for at least 8,000 years. Are you telling me that they knew that there was underground water, but somehow they never would have thought to include water coming up from under the ground in their story unless they knew about hydrous ringwoodite hundreds of kilometers down? It seems to me that the knowledge of groundwater could have been a contributing factor to the idea that the Earth is floating on a giant cosmic sea. Dig down, and you put a hole in our Earth boat so water comes out.
Yet we're just now discovering it. That's always kind of I love discoveries like this because when people ask, well, where'd the water come from? Where'd the water go?
It's still a valid question, Cotton-Eyed Joe. Do you have a mechanism by which the water could have been brought forth from the mantle at such a rapid rate and then have returned to it almost equally rapidly? No, you don't. You just found out that there's a large quantity of water that exists there and decided that the existence of the water is itself all the evidence that you need that the flood is real. Well, Mr. Scientist, that's bad science.
I mean, we're literally seeing it, and leading geologists are telling us that this water, that our surface water that we now currently have, oozed up from below the Earth.
Therefore, flood. Sorry, no, that doesn't work.
Just like Moses told us.
That is not what Moses told us. Where in any of the Pentateuch does it state that hydroxyl radicals could be found within minerals buried 600 kilometers below the surface of the Earth? It doesn't. The fact that humans have known about groundwater that is close enough that you can dig a well to access it is enough to explain how the author of Genesis could have thought that the water would come up from the ground.
Again, it kind of goes down to, You know, I'm not saying, you know, everything I like, because again, I started this with, I don't know anything beyond 4,500 years, nor do you, nor does any scientist out there.
Ergo, you started this from a completely incorrect position. Ergo, your conclusions drawn as a result of the starting position are also completely incorrect.
What I'm saying is you can't say 200 million years ago anything.
And you're wrong.
And then whenever you see what God shares with us, that hey, here's how it all went down, but yet you can see evidence of that on the earth as a scientist, it just helps you see the proof of God. So,
no, it doesn't. It proves that ancient civilizations that are known to have dug wells knew that you could dig wells. That's it. That's what you accomplished here. Well done. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Nathaniel Gray, who says, is he allergic to getting to the point? This was on a Brian Holdsworth video, and I would suggest that yes, he is. I've considered covering a number of his videos, but I almost always decide against it because once you cut through the fluff and sophistry, you're left with almost nothing, and it just gets so boring so quickly. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the scientists who took the intro courses to biology and chemistry on my channel. If you'd like to pretend you have credentials that you obviously don't, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form, the link for that is also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time!